generates and renews the world, with the figure that mediates between order and chaos. It is within the domain of that figure that room for all aspects of the personality actually exist. As the demands placed on the individual who wishes to identify with the Savior are so high, so to speak, that every aspect of personality must become manifested, redeemed, and integrated into a functioning hierarchy. The revaluation of good and evil therefore allows for the creative reintegration of those aspects of personality and their secondary representations in imagination and idea, previously suppressed and stunted by immature moral ideation, including that represented by group affiliation, posited as the highest level of ethical attainment. The act of turning away from something anomalous is the process of labeling that anomalous thing as too terrifying to be encountered or considered in its most fundamental form. To avoid something is also to define it, and in a more general sense, to define oneself. To avoid is to say, that is too terrible, and that means too terrible for me. The impossibility of a task is necessarily determined in relationship to the abilities of the one faced with it. The act of turning away therefore means willful opposition to the process of adaptation, since nothing new can happen when everything new is avoided or suppressed. The act of facing an anomaly, by contrast, is the process of labeling that event as tolerable, and, simultaneously, the definition of oneself as the agent able to so tolerate. Adoption of such a stance means the possibility of further growth, since it is in contact with anomaly that new information is generated. This faith in oneself and the benevolence of the world manifests itself as the courage to risk everything in the pursuit of meaning. If the nature of the goal is shifted from desire for predictability to development of personality capable of facing chaos voluntarily, then the unknown, which can never be permanently banished, will no longer be associated with fear, and safety, paradoxically, will be permanently established. Solzhenitsyn concludes, "It was granted me to carry away from my prison years on my bent back, which nearly broke beneath its load, this essential experience, how a human being becomes evil and how good. In the intoxication of youthful successes, I had felt myself to be infallible, and I was, therefore, cruel. In the surfeit of power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, I was convinced that I was doing good, and I was well supplied with systematic arguments. And it was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart, and through all human hearts. This line shifts. Inside us, it oscillates with the years. And even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an uprooted small corner of evil. Since then, I have come to understand the truth of all the religions of the world. They struggle with the evil inside a human being, inside every human being. It is impossible to expel evil from the world in its entirety, but it is possible to constrict it within each person. And since that time, I have come to understand the falsehood of all the revolutions in history. They destroy only those carriers of evil contemporary with them, and also fail out of haste to discriminate the carriers of good as well. and they then take to themselves as their heritage the actual evil itself, magnified still more. The Nuremberg trials have to be regarded as one of the special achievements of the 20th century. They killed the very idea of evil, though they killed very few of the people who had been infected by it. Of course, Stalin deserves no credit here. He would have preferred to explain less and shoot more. And if, by the 21st century, humanity has not yet blown itself up and has not suffocated itself, perhaps it is this direction that will triumph. Yes, and if it does not triumph, then all humanity's history will have turned out to be an empty exercise in marking time, without the tiniest mite of meaning. Whither and to what end will we otherwise be moving? To beat the enemy over the head with a club? Even cavemen knew that. Know thyself. There is nothing that so aids and assists the awakening of omniscience within us as insistent thoughts about one's own transgressions, errors, mistakes. After the difficult cycles of such ponderings over many years, whenever I mentioned the heartlessness of our highest-ranking bureaucrats, the cruelty of our executioners, I remember myself in my captain's shoulder boards and the forward march of my battery through East Prussia, enshrouded in fire, and I say, so were we any better? Heroic adaptation. Voluntary reconstruction of the map of meaning. The group provides the protective structure, conditional meaning and behavioral pattern that enables the individual to cast off the dependence of childhood to make the transition from the maternal to the social patriarchal world. The group is not the individual, however. Psychological development that ceases with group identification, held up as the highest attainable good by every ideologue, severely constricts individual and social potential and dooms the group inevitably to sudden and catastrophic dissolution. Failure to transcend group identification is, in the final analysis, as pathological as failure to leave childhood. Movement from the group to the individual, like that from childhood to group, follows the archetypal transformative pattern of the heroic. Paradise, breach, fall, redemption. Stability, incorporation, dissolution, reconstruction. Such transformation must be undertaken voluntarily through conscious exposure to the unknown, although it may be catalyzed by sufficiently unique or traumatic experience. Failure to initiate and or successfully complete the process of secondary maturation heightens risk for intrapsychic and social decadence and consequent experiential chaos, depression, and anxiety, including suicidal ideation, or enhances tendency toward fanaticism and consequent intrapsychic and group aggression. The Bible, considered as a single story, presents this process of maturation in mythological terms. The Old Testament offers group identity codified by Moses as antidote for the fallen state of man. This antidote, while useful, is incomplete. Even Moses himself, a true ancestral hero, fails to reach the promised land. The New Testament, by contrast, offers identification with the hero as the means by which the fallen state and the problems of group identity might both be permanently transcended. The New Testament has been traditionally read as a description of a historical event which redeemed mankind once and for all. It might more reasonably be considered the description of a process that, if enacted, could bring about the establishment of peace on earth. The problem is, however, that this process cannot yet really be said to be consciously, that is, explicitly, understood. Furthermore, if actually undertaken, it is extremely frightening, particularly in the initial stages. In consequence, the imitation of Christ, or the central culture hero of other religious systems, tends to take the form of ritualistic worship, separated from other non-religious aspects of life. Voluntary participation in the heroic process, by contrast, which means courageous confrontation with the unknown, makes worship a matter of true identification. This means that the true believer rises above dogmatic adherence to realize the soul of the hero, to incarnate that soul in every aspect of his day-to-day life. This is easy to say, but very difficult to understand and to do. It is no easy matter to translate the transpersonal myth of the hero into a template for action and representation in the unique conditions that make up an individual life. It appears equally troublesome, even hubristic, to presume that the individual might be a force worthy of identification with the hero. Nonetheless, we are more than we seem, and are more trouble than we imagine when undisciplined and unrealized. The banality of evil, Hannah Arendt's famous phrase, applied to the oft unprepossessing Nazi personality, is, more accurately, the evil of banality. Our petty weaknesses accumulate and multiply and become the great evils of state. As our technological power expands, the danger we pose increases, and the consequences of our voluntary stupidity multiply. It is increasingly necessary that we set ourselves, not others, right, and that we learn explicitly what that means. The nature of the process of identification with the hero can be understood in great detail as a consequence of the analysis of alchemy, which Jung made his life's work. Alchemy, considered most generally as the precursor of modern chemistry, was in fact a 20 centuries long endeavor to understand the transformations of matter. The alchemical matter, however, was not the matter of modern science. Logically enough, as the ancient alchemists practiced in the absence of the presumptions and tools of modern science, it was a substance more like Tao, that which produced or constituted the flux of being, something more like information in the modern sense, if information may be considered latent in unexplored places, something more like the unknown as such, something like the matrix of being. Investigation of this intrinsically compelling matter, this unknown, produced a series of internal transformations in the alchemical psyche, making it ever more akin to the philosopher's stone, something that could turn base matter into spiritual gold, something that had, in addition, the eternal, durable, and indestructible nature of stone. As the alchemical endeavor progressed through the Christian era, the stone became increasingly assimilated to Christ, the cornerstone rejected by the builders, the agent of voluntary transformation, whose actions eternally transform the fallen world into paradise. The late-stage alchemists posited that a personality that had completely assimilated the spirit of the unknown was equivalent to Christ. Jung translated their image-laden mythological language into something more comprehensible, but not yet understood. The terrible central message of this mode of thought is this: do not lie, particularly to yourself, or you will undermine the process that gives you the strength to bear the tragic world. In your weakness, the consequence of your lie, you will become cruel, arrogant, and vengeful. You will then serve as an unconscious emissary of the agent of destruction, and work to bring about the end of life. The creative illness and the hero. I-N-R-I, Igni Natura Renovatur Integra, all nature is through fire renewed. According to John Dee, occult interpretation of the phrase I-N-R-I, satirically inscribed, as tradition has it, on Christ's cross. Iusus Nazarenes, Rex Ludeorum, Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews. The third mode of adaptation, alternative to decadence and fascism, is heroic. Heroism is comparatively rare because it requires voluntary sacrifice of group-fostered certainty and indefinite acceptance of consequent psychological chaos attendant upon re-exposure to the unknown. This is nonetheless the creative path, leading to new discovery or reconfiguration, comprising the living element of culture. The creative actor adopts the role of hero and places himself beyond, even in opposition to, the protective enclave of history. In consequence, he suffers re-exposure to the terrible unknown. Such re-exposure engenders mortal terror, but allows for union with possibility, allows for inspiration, reconstruction, and advancement. It is the disintegration and disinhibition of meaning preceding its reintegration, occurrences necessarily attendant upon the heroic process, that produce the phenomena linking genius in the popular imagination with insanity. The genius and the lunatic are separated, however, by their relative position with regard to the unknown. The genius is the fortunate hero who faces the unexpected consequences of his insufficiently adaptive behavior voluntarily, on ground that he has chosen. The unfortunate madman, by contrast, has run away from something carnivorous, something that thrives on neglect and grows larger, something that will finally devour him. The genius dissolves, is flooded with indeterminate meaning, and is then reconstituted, then dissolves, floods, and reconfigures the social world. The psychotic dissolves and drowns in the flood. It is capacity to voluntarily face the unknown and to reconfigure accordingly the propositions that guided past adaptation that constitutes the eternal spirit of man, the world-creating word. The existence and nature of that spirit has been granted due recognition in Western and Eastern philosophy and religion since time immemorial. The eminent theologist Reinhold Niebuhr states, "In both Plato and Aristotle, mind is sharply distinguished from the body. It is the unifying and ordering principle, the organ of logos, which brings harmony into the life of the soul, as logos is the creative and forming principle of the world. Greek metaphysical presuppositions are naturally determinative for the doctrine of man, and since Parmenides, Greek philosophy had assumed an identity between being and reason on the one hand, and on the other presupposed that reason works upon some formless or unformed stuff which is never completely tractable. In the thought of Aristotle, matter is a remnant, the non-existent in itself unknowable and alien to reason, that remains after the process of clarifying the thing into form and conception. This non-existent neither is nor is not. It is not yet. That is to say, it attains reality only insofar as it becomes the vehicle of some conceptual determination. The notion of the spirit's intrinsic kinship with the Creator was abstractly elaborated in much more detail in the eventual course of development of Judeo-Christian thought. From this viewpoint, man is understood most profoundly in terms of his relationship to God, as made in the image of God, rather than in light of his cognitive abilities or his place in nature. The essence of this spirit identified with God is the eternal capacity to create and to transform. Niebuhr observes that the human spirit has the special capacity of standing continually outside itself in terms of indefinite regression. The self knows the world insofar as it knows the world because it stands outside both itself and the world, which means that it cannot understand itself except as it is understood from beyond itself and the world. This capacity for infinite transcendence, which is the ability to abstract and then represent the abstraction, and then abstract from the representation, and so on, without end, does not come without a cost, as we have previously observed. We can tumble down the house of cards as easily as erect it. Furthermore, our capacity for evil is integrally linked with our ability to overcome boundaries. Abstract thinking in general, and abstract moral thinking in particular, is play. The game, what if? Games are played by first establishing, then identifying, then altering basic presuppositions. Before any game can be played, the rules have to be established. Before the game can be altered, the rules have to be made manifest. A game, at least in its final stages, is played by constructing an image of the world in imagination in accordance with certain presuppositions, which are the rules, the environment of the game, and then by acting in that imaginary world. This game construction, playing and modifying, is a form of practice for real-world activity. As games increase in complexity, in fact, it becomes increasingly difficult to distinguish them from real-world activity. The game itself, at its first stages, is played at the procedural level. The rules remain implicit. Once a representation of the game has been established, then the game can be shared. Later, the rules themselves can be altered. The child psychologist Jean Piaget discusses the formulation of the rules of children's games. From the point of view of the practice or application of rules, four successive stages can be distinguished. A first stage of a purely motor and individual character, during which the child handles the marbles at the dictation of his desires and motor habits. This leads to the formation of more or less ritualized schemas. But since play is still purely individual, one can only talk of motor rules and not of truly collective rules. The second may be called egocentric for the following reasons. This stage begins at the moment when the child receives from outside the example of codified rules, that is to say, sometime between the ages of 2 and 5. But, though the child imitates this example, he continues to play either by himself without bothering to find playfellows, or with others, but without trying to win, and therefore without attempting to unify the different ways of playing. In other words, children of this stage, even when they are playing together, play each one on his own. Everyone can win at once, and without regard for any codification of rules. This dual character, combining imitation of others with a purely individual use of the examples received, we have designated by the term egocentrism. A third stage appears between 7 and 8, which we shall call the stage of incipient cooperation. Each player now tries to win, and all, therefore, begin to concern themselves with the question of mutual control and of unification of the rules. But while a certain agreement may be reached in the course of one game, ideas about the rules in general are still rather vague. In other words, children of 7 to 8, who belong to the same class at school and are therefore constantly playing with each other, give, when they are questioned separately, disparate and often entirely contradictory accounts of the rules observed in playing marbles. Finally, between the years of 11 and 12, appears a fourth stage, which is that of the codification of rules. Not only is every detail of procedure in the game fixed, but the actual code of rules to be observed is known to the whole society. There is remarkable concordance in the information given by children of 10 to 12 belonging to the same class at school when they are questioned on the rules of the game and their possible variations. If, now, we turn to the consciousness of rules, we shall find a progression that is even more elusive in detail, but no less clearly marked if taken on a big scale. We may express this by saying that the progression runs through three stages, of which the second begins during the egocentric stage and ends towards the middle of the stage of cooperation, 9 to 10, and of which the third covers the remainder of this cooperating stage and the whole of the stage marked by the codification of rules. During the first stage, rules are not yet coercive in character, either because they are purely motor, or else, at the beginning of the egocentric stage, because they are received, as it were, unconsciously, and as interesting examples, rather than as obligatory realities. During the second stage, apogee of egocentric and first half of cooperating stage, rules are regarded as sacred and untouchable, emanating from adults, and lasting forever. Every suggested alteration strikes the child as a transgression. Finally, during the third stage, a rule is looked upon as a law due to mutual consent, which you must respect if you want to be loyal, but which it is permissible to alter on the condition of enlisting general opinion on your side. The correlation between the three stages in the development of the consciousness of rules and the four stages relating to their practical observance is, of course, only a statistical correlation and therefore very crude. But broadly speaking, the relation seems to us indisputable. The collective rule is at first something external to the individual and, consequently, sacred to him. Then, as he gradually makes it his own, it comes to that extent to be felt as the free product of mutual agreement and an autonomous conscience. And with regard to practical use, it is only natural that a mystical respect for laws should be accompanied by a rudimentary knowledge and application of their contents, while a rational and well-founded respect is accompanied by an effective application of each rule in detail. The second stage child, who accepts the presuppositions of his cultural subtradition as sacred and untouchable, thinks in a manner similar to the classic, partially hypothetical, pre-experimental or primitive man who worships the past in representation as absolute truth. The child and the primitive are both concerned primarily with how to behave, how to organize behavior contra nature in the social community, to simultaneously and continuously meet ends deemed desirable. It is only much later, after these most fundamental of issues have been resolved, that the means of resolution themselves can be questioned. This act of higher order conceptualization means emergence of ability to play games with the rules of games, and belief in the justifiability of such activity, this rebuff to traditional order. This more abstract ability allows for answer to the meta-problem of morality posed much earlier, not how to behave, but how can, or is, or was, how to behave be determined. Paradoxically, perhaps, the answer to this meta-problem also provides the final answer to the apparently less abstract question, how to behave, or what is the good? Some examples from Western religious tradition may aid in comprehending, 1, the nature of the distinction between morality's central problem, what is the good, and meta-problem, how are the answers to the question, what is the good, determined? 2, the structure of their attendant resolutions. And 3, the manner in which the meta-problem and its solution follow in the course of historical development from the problem and its solution, attended by cyclical development of increasingly sophisticated and powerful self-consciousness. Let us begin with the problem of self-consciousness, which appears in part as enhanced ability of the declarative memory system to accurately encode the nature of human behavior, self and other. This encoding first takes the form of the narrative or myth, which, as stated previously, is semantic use of episodic representation of procedural wisdom. Semantic analysis of narrative, criticism, allows for derivation of abstracted moral principles. First order, pure semantic codification of the morality implicit in behavior and then in episodic semantic, narrative, or mythic representation appears to take the form of the list. A list of laws, moral rules, straightforwardly and simply defines what constitutes acceptable behavior and what does not. An explicit list serves as an admirable guide for the adolescent emerging from the maternal world. Such a list might be regarded as the most basic form of explicit moral philosophy. The list emerges into the narrative of Judeo-Christian consciousness as a consequence of the actions of the figure of Moses, who serves as lawgiver for the Jewish people. Moses has many of the attributes of the typical mythical hero and constitutes a figure analogous to that of the supernatural ancestor of the primitive. He is characterized by endangered birth, for example, and by dual parentage, one set humble, one exalted or divine. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shipra and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives, and said unto them, why have ye done this thing, and saved the men children alive? And the midwife said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively, and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. And there went a man of the house of Levi, and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes, and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side, and when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child. And, behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away, and nurse it for me, and I will give thee wages. And the woman took the child, and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. Exodus 1:15-22, 2:1-10. After Moses reaches adulthood, he rejects his secondary Egyptian heritage and rejoins the Hebrews, in time becoming their leader and leading them away from Egypt and Egyptian servitude, from slavery under tyranny. He takes them on a heroic journey, from the unbearable and fallen present condition, through the purgatorial desert, where they act in accordance with procedures he establishes, to earthly paradise itself, the promised land of milk and honey. Northrop Frye comments, "The biblical pattern for the purgatorial vision is the Exodus narrative, which is in three major parts. First is the sojourn in Egypt, the furnace of iron, a world visited by plagues, where the Egyptian desire to exterminate the Hebrews goes into reverse with the slaughter of the Egyptian firstborn sons. This episode concludes with the crossing of the Red Sea, the separation of Israel from Egypt, and the drowning of the Egyptian host. The second episode is the wandering in the wilderness, a labyrinthine period of lost direction, where one generation has to die off before a new one can enter the promised land. Psalm 95:11. This is one of several features indicating that we are in a world transcending history, and that it is in the more poetic language of the prophets that the true or symbolic meaning of Egypt, wilderness, and promised land emerges more clearly. The third stage is the entry into the promised land, where Moses, personifying the older generation, dies just outside it. In Christian typology, this means that the law, which Moses symbolizes, cannot redeem mankind. Only his successor Joshua, who bears the same name as Jesus, can invade and conquer Canaan. Moses is a revolutionary. He teaches his people a new mode of being. This means he revalues their goals as well as their means. This process of revolutionary readaptation is necessarily preceded by a period of intense suffering as the affects released by the new situation fight among themselves, so to speak, until subdued. The biblical story portrays this process dramatically, presenting it in terms of the lengthy and trying desert sojourn. The provision of heavenly food during this time is a hint to the meaning, so to speak, of the story. The interregnum of pain and confusion that precedes the reestablishment or improvement of stability can be tolerated only by those fed on spiritual bread, can be tolerated only by those who have incorporated sufficient meaning and have therefore developed wisdom, patience, and faith. In the course of the Exodus, Moses begins to serve as judge for his people. He is spontaneously chosen by them, perhaps on the basis of perceived strength or integration of character as mediator between conflicting claims of value. In this role, he is forced to determine what was right or what should be, and what was wrong or comparatively wrong. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto even?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws." Exodus 18:13-16. Adoption of this responsibility entails voluntary acceptance of tremendous intrapsychic strain, strain associated with necessity of constant demanding moral judgment, establishment of hierarchical order, resultant of intrapsychic quasi-Darwinian struggle of abstracted values, and, when the ability is there, consequent generation of compensatory adaptive activity. In the mythic case of Moses, such activity took the form of translation. Translation of moral principles from procedure and narrative representation thereof into an abstract semantic code. This act of translation constituted a tremendous leap forward, a qualitative shift in human cognition, regardless of whether it was actually undertaken by Moses or by any number of individuals over hundreds of years. A flash in time, nonetheless, from the evolutionary perspective, and conflated into a single event by the socially mediated process of mythological memory. The emergence of moral knowledge in explicit semantic form, as opposed to its implicit representation in narrative, appears represented in mythology as brought about by revelation. This revelation is reception of knowledge from a higher source, in this case, from the episodic to the semantic memory systems, from the mysterious domain of imagination to the concrete word. Generation, disinhibition, more accurately, of overwhelming affect will necessarily characterize transitions in cognitive ability of this magnitude, generation akin to that accompanying the insight phenomena typical of creative or psychotherapeutic endeavor. This might be considered a consequence of initial temporary establishment of intrapsychic integration, establishment of isomorphism or concordance between the procedural, episodic, and semantic memory systems, and recognition of the manifold possibilities, the hitherto unforeseen redemptive opportunities, thereby released. The first discovery of a new categorization system means immediate apprehension of the broad potential utility of those things newly comprehended, means understanding of the refreshed promise. This first discovery, eureka, is the positive aspect of the voluntary renovelization of experience. This process is dramatically represented in Exodus by the transformation of Moses' appearance as a consequence of his protracted encounter with God. And he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did neither eat bread nor drink water. And he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the 10 commandments. And it came to pass, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the 2 tables of testimony in Moses' hand, when he came down from the mount, that Moses wist not that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come nigh him. And Moses called unto them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned unto him, and Moses talked with them. And afterward all the children of Israel came nigh, and he gave them in commandment all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. Exodus 34:28-32. This shining face is mythic, semantic, episodic, equation of the individual with solar power, symbolic of illumination, enlightenment, momentary transfiguration into eternal representative of the gods. This great leap forward places Moses temporarily into the company of God. Moses transforms what had previously been custom, embedded in behavior, represented in myth, into an explicit semantic code. The Decalogue is the single most fundamental subset of the new code. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the 3rd and 4th generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor, and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy castle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor thy father and thy mother. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Exodus 20:3-17. Codification of tradition is necessarily dependent upon existence of tradition, established adaptive behavior, and secondary representation thereof. The knowledge embodied in such tradition exists as a consequence of evolutionary pressure, so to speak, operating primarily in the literal sense at the level of interpersonal action, and is only secondarily, lately, translated up the hierarchy of consciousness to representation. This means that evolution proceeds at least as often, and generally more profoundly, from behavior to representation, episodic and semantic. From adaptive action and mythic portrayal thereof, all true art included, to abstract verbal knowledge, as from representation to behavior. Translation of tradition into law makes verbally abstract what had previously been, at best, encoded in image, makes the morality of the culture and the moral individual conscious for the first time. This act of transformation, culminating in a qualitative shift of cognitive sophistication in the intrapsychic activity of a mythologized culture hero, constitutes the consequence of centuries of abstract adaptive endeavor. The actions of the hero are identified with heavenly attributes by the story to signify the import and intrapsychic locale and source of the revolutionary occurrence. Nietzsche states, "Great men, like great epochs, are explosive material in whom tremendous energy has been accumulated. Their prerequisite has always been, historically and physiologically, that a protracted assembling, accumulating, economizing, and preserving has preceded them, that there has been no explosion for a long time. If the tension in the mass has grown too great, the merest accidental stimulus suffices to call the genius, the deed, the great destiny into the world." The moral presumptions of a society emerge first in procedural form as a consequence of individual exploratory activity, which is the process that generates novel behavioral patterns. These behavioral patterns are then hierarchically structured as a consequence of quasi-Darwinian competition, in accordance with the constraints noted previously, appeal to imagination, self-sustenance, etc. The episodic memory systems map procedure and outcome thereof, and thereby come to contain similar paradigmatic structure, imagistically and then more purely semantically. Over time, the unknown nature thereby comes to be represented mythically as the affectively bivalent Great Mother, simultaneously creative and destructive. The known culture becomes the Great Father, tyrant and wise king, authoritarian and protective personality, adapted to the unknown. The knower, man, becomes the hostile mythic brothers, sons of convention, hero and anti-hero, Christ and Satan, eternal generator and destroyer of history and tradition. Semantic cognition, feeding on narrative, the bridge between the episode and the pure verbal abstraction, derives rules from behavior. Application of the rules alters the environment, including procedural and episodic representations thereof. Thus, the cycle continues. Culture protects the individual against the consequences of his or her vulnerability, at least in its positive aspect, but the price paid for absolute security is freedom and individuality, and therefore creativity. Sacrifice of individual creativity by choice eventually deprives life of pleasure, of meaning, but not of anxiety or pain, and therefore renders life unbearable. Civilized or historical Homo sapiens grows up within a structured canon of principles implicitly and explicitly posited and held as absolute by the majority of individuals within his or her civilization. In return for this legacy, which is in fact the sum total of the efforts of mankind over thousands of years, the individual is molded and shaped and can therefore survive independently. But all this shaping is not purely beneficial. It is an unhappy fact that the intrinsically rewarding, implicitly interesting activities associated with individual heroism often come to pose a threat to the established structure of the group. The Great Father, positive aspect of history, protects man from the terrible mother. He is civilized order, education and wisdom embodied and represented, the abstracted and integrated personification of all those heroes who have come before and left their mark on the cultural behavior of the species. He is ritual model for emulation, good king, wise judge, man of courage, of action, of art, of thought. Insofar as he represents particular specific patterns of action, however, he is the enemy of possibility, of life in the present itself, of the hero, and is therefore necessarily captor of the spirit, embodiment of the tyrant, the bureaucrat. This is history as the terrible father, dead weight of the past, crushing mass of narrow, bigoted, ill-informed opinion and popular prejudice. This is the force that oppresses the good mother, the creative aspect of life itself. The terrible father opposes anything new, anything that threatens his integral structure and absolute dominance. Identification of the well-adapted man with his culture means that as history becomes established in counterposition to the force that nature represents, the creative hero has to battle public opinion, composed, when ideological, of contemporary slogans, Slueg Germs, Welsh, battle cries of the dead, as well as the forces of the natural unknown. The hero is an enemy of the historically determined structure of values and assumptions, because he may have to reorder that structure and not merely add to it or maintain it, to deal with what still remains unknown. In that process of reordering, unfortunately, he risks exposing himself and all those well-adapted men who identify with and maintain that culture to the terrible forces of the unknown, to mortal anxiety and dread, to fear of the void, to terror of insanity, physical destruction, and annihilation. These ideas are dramatically presented in Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor, in The Brothers Karamazov. Ivan, tormented atheist, tells a story he has invented to his religiously minded younger brother, Alyosha, a novice at the local monastery. Christ returns to earth, to Seville, during the time of the Spanish Inquisition. He came unobserved and moved about silently. But strangely enough, those who saw him recognized him at once. This might perhaps be the best part of my poem if I could explain what made them recognize him. People are drawn to him by an irresistible force. They gather around him, follow him, and soon there is a crowd. He walks among them in silence, a gentle smile of infinite compassion on his lips. The sun of love burns in his heart. Light, understanding, and spiritual power flow from his eyes and set people's hearts vibrating with love for him. He holds his hands out to them, blesses them, and just from touching him or even his clothes comes a healing power. An old man who has been blind from childhood suddenly cries out to him, "Cure me, O Lord, so that I may see you too." And it is as if scales had fallen from his eyes, and the blind man sees him. People weep and kiss the ground on which he walks. Children scatter flowers in his path and cry out to him, "Hosanna! It is he himself." People keep saying, "Who else could it be?" He stops on the steps of the Cathedral of Seville at a moment when a small white coffin is carried into the church by weeping bearers. In it lies a girl of 7, the only daughter of a prominent man. She lies there amidst flowers. "He will raise your child from the dead," people shout to the weeping mother. The priest, who has come out of the cathedral to meet the procession, looks perplexed and frowns. But now the mother of the dead child throws herself at his feet, wailing, "If it is truly you, give me back my child." And she stretches out her hands to him. The procession stops. They put the coffin down at his feet. He looks down with compassion. His lips form the words, "Talitha kumi." "Arise, maiden." And the maiden arises. The little girl sits up in her coffin, opens her little eyes, looks around in surprise, and smiles. She holds the white roses that had been placed in her hand when they had laid her in the coffin. There is confusion among the people, shouting and weeping. Just at that moment, the cardinal, the grand inquisitor himself, crosses the cathedral square. He is a man of almost 90, tall and erect. His face is drawn. His eyes are sunken. But they still glow as though a spark smoldered in them. Oh, now he is not wearing his magnificent cardinal's robes in which he paraded before the crowds the day before when they were burning the enemies of the Roman Church. No, today he is wearing just the coarse cassock of an ordinary monk. He is followed by his grisly assistants, his slaves, his holy guard. He sees the crowd gathered, stops, and watches from a distance. He sees everything, the placing of the coffin and the girl rising from it. His face darkens. He knits his thick white brows. His eyes flash with an ominous fire. He points his finger and orders his guards to seize him. The Grand Inquisitor's power is so great, and the people are so submissive and tremblingly obedient to him, that they immediately open up a passage for the guards. A death-like silence descends upon the square, and in that silence the guards lay hands on him and lead him away. Then everyone in the crowd, to a man, prostrates himself before the Grand Inquisitor. The old man blesses them in silence and passes on. The guards take their prisoner to an old building of the Holy Inquisition and lock him up there in a dark, narrow, vaulted prison cell. The day declines and is replaced by the stifling black southern night of Seville. The air is fragrant with laurel and lemon. Suddenly, in the complete darkness, the iron gate of the cell opens, and there stands the Grand Inquisitor himself, holding a light in his hand. The old man enters the cell alone, and when he is inside, the door closes behind him. He stops, and for a long time, 1 or even 2 minutes, he looks at him. At last, he sets the light down on the table and says, You? Is it really you? Receiving no answer, he continues in great haste. You need not answer me. Say nothing. I know only too well what you could tell me now. Besides, you have no right to add anything to what you said before. Why did you come here? To interfere and make things difficult for us? For you came to interfere.